Okay, thank you. So you all usually see the polished media-friendly life expectancy map, but I did want to spend a little time today letting you see what's under the hood. Sort of disclosure statement. I would like to acknowledge my co-authors, Lauren Kelly, Stephen Cohen, our demographer, and Steve Wolf, as well as two research team members that work really hard on our maps, Kristen Smith and Lindsay Hall. And I especially want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for all of the great work they fund, including this Life Expectancy Maps project. So life expectancy is computed using a life table. We use the Chang 2 method if you want to look up the official publications. But I think Steve had mentioned earlier, it traditionally was computed at the state or national level. So it wasn't originally designed for use in small areas. Life expectancy predicts the average age at death based on historic mortality data for each age group that appears in the life table. So the data you need for this life table includes age-specific counts of mortality. So you'll get this from state or local vital records. We used all-cause mortality for this project, but you could limit it to certain causes and look at life expectancy associated with certain health conditions. The second piece, for your denominator, you need population. So you need age-specific population that matches your age-specific mortality counts. And we obtained this from the Census Bureau. In this project, we computed it for the total population, but you could also compute life expectancy for different subgroups. So, for example, by race or sex. So life expectancy at birth is what we computed, and that process traces a hypothetical cohort of newborn infants throughout their entire lifespan. So although you only see the 5 or 6 life expectancy values on the maps we release, there's actually a life table created for each of the 20 to 40 zip codes or census tracts in and around the map that we release for media purposes. And all of those areas are listed in tabular form on a method sheet that we release alongside the map that are available on our website. So each row in this table, it's a little tough to see, but I just want to kind of step through. I'm happy to share these slides and talk to you in more detail about it. But each row in this table represents an age group in the life table. So this is an abridged life table that uses groups of ages. You could also use individual years of age if you had a large enough sample size. So each row is age groups, and this is a 19-group solution we use for most of our maps. So that's infants in 5-year age groups up to age 85. So the first column in this table is your actual population, or the average actual population, or the midpoint population of the years under study. Second column is simply the average number of deaths in the time period that the age for each of the age categories. So age-specific population, age-specific deaths. The next column in white here, the NMX, is just the age-specific mortality rate, so just deaths divided by population. Then NQX in green is the age-specific probability of dying, which is just derived from the mortality rate. And then LX in purple is the number of survivors in the synthetic cohort at each age. So we just see this with 100,000. So we just have an imaginary cohort of 100,000 newborns we plop in this table, and then we apply the mortality rates at each age and results in the surviving population. So that's what the NDX column in white here is simply the number of deaths in our synthetic cohort. So that is simply computed by taking the probability of death times the number of people in that age group. And that's the number of deaths, and we just subtract those deaths off from each age group all the way down to the end. Then the light blue column next to this is the... Oh, and I gotta move ahead. There we go. So the deaths up there. So the NLX in the light blue column is the number of person years lived in the age interval. All right, so this is just taking the average number of population in the surviving age group and the number of population in the next surviving age group. So it's the average of those two times the number of years. So it's just person years, just like everything else. How many years live per population. And then the TX column is just the number of person years cumulatively lived above that age interval. So it's basically this person years in each interval accumulated up to the top. And then life expectancy itself is then just simply this TX, person years lived above each age interval, divided by the surviving population at each interval. So we have life expectancy at every age group. In this case, life expectancy at birth is 76.7 for the age group of zero or infants. So, you know, like many, many things in statistics, kind of once you know how to do it, it's pretty easy. And the calculation itself is a simple fraction. There's really not a lot of excitement in the actual calculation. All of the work goes into the data collection, cleaning, and dealing with anomalies in the data. So like most things, the final code is one little button you push, but there's a lot of work that goes really into the cleaning part, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So there are a lot of assumptions about life tables, always assumptions in EPI, and you need to be aware of them. Number one is kind of a universal thing, and that's numerators are accurate, so you have to have accurate counts of deaths or your numbers are off a little. And so at small areas, the issues come from potentially inaccuracies in geocoding, wrong zip codes or wrong counties being coded in vital records. So anything that messes up your counts of deaths will bias your life expectancy calculations. Second one is the other obvious one, the matching denominator. The population counts also have to be accurate. So we do know that population can and does change over time. And accurate counts of small areas outside full census years can be difficult to obtain. So you often, and as we did when we have multiple years of data, have to interpolate the population counts in the intercensal years when the census isn't when the census year itself isn't the midpoint of your data. So space and group affiliations are assumed to remain constant, right, because we're calculating it for this area based on this synthetic cohort. So we have these imaginary infants all born in that same area. But of course, we know that census tract boundaries are changing with each census, and especially zip codes are especially subject to change at any time, not just every 10 years. And so we keep mentioning the synthetic cohort. So because life expectancy is this, you know, imaginary cohort we put inside this table, all of the entries and exits into that life table are assumed to be because of the 100,000 births you put there and the deaths you take out. So you can figure out really quickly that this assumes that there is no migration occurring in or out of that geography. So of course this is particularly absurd at the smallest geographic level. It's not even really true at the state or even national level. There's always in and out migration. And even if it were the case that people stayed in the same zip code their whole lives, the exposures that accumulate throughout the lifespan are often not constrained to your zip code of residence. You still leave the zip code and get exposed to things outside of there. So these limitations exist for all life expectancy calculations. They're just magnified when calculating at the smaller and smaller areas. The assumptions get a little shakier as you go. So a couple of examples visually of what we're seeing. This is a change in census tract boundaries from Prince William County in Northern Virginia, where five tracts split into eight between the 2000 and 2010 censuses. The whole Northern Virginia region actually has grown a lot. It grew from 329 to 528 tracts between censuses. This doesn't happen everywhere, but a lot of places with large population growth, this is a big issue. So in this particular project, when we mapped Northern Virginia, we ended up reverting back to the 2000 census boundaries so that we could use more years of census data, because the data had been geocoded by the health department at different time points and we needed more years of data. So one solution was just to put them back. Other geographies have more complicated problems than tracts. You know, zip codes are great for helping a post office deliver mail, but the mail carrier doesn't stop at the county or the census tract boundaries. So this is from Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. We've got Orange County and Chapel Hill City, Durham County, Raleigh City, and Wake County. So we see zip code 25760 spans two counties and two cities. We have zip code 27713 has parts of it in all three counties and the city of Durham. So definitely an issue if your If you, some of the places where we request data, they have the data for the city only. So they've got deaths for just the piece of the zip that's in the city, but your population comes from the entire zip code from the census. So in those cases, we had to apportion the population based on the land area, the percentage of the land area that's in that county. So why should we even compute it at all? After all these issues, why do we even bother computing small area life expectancy? We spend a lot of time talking about how bad it is, but although it's not perfect, it can be an effective policy tool. So it is really good at identifying areas of relative disadvantage. You know, all that migration that happens in and out of areas is not completely random, right? We often have moves within the same socioeconomic strata and rarely have shifts from, you know, an area of town with public housing to the highest income neighborhoods and vice versa. It's also a really good summary measure of population health. So Abby had mentioned, you know, it's readily understood, it resonates with public and policymakers, and is a great conversation starter. And a quick example I can give of that is, for the first time in my entire professional career, I had a conversation with all three of my teenage daughters about my work. My college-age daughter tweeted out the map and had a conversation with her friends about that. My high school-age daughter's teacher saw me talking about the Richmond map on the news, talked to her about it in class, and she came home and asked me questions the teacher asked so she could follow up the next day. And my prize story is my middle schooler, out of nowhere at dinner, said, "Hey, those life expectancy differences we see on the maps, those are really just about poverty, right, Dad?" And I got very excited and launched into my lecture about how, well, it's not just poverty, it's... And she cut me off and said, "That's all I want to know. Thanks, Dad." So that conversation ended, but I never had a conversation with all three children about work. So anyway, it's a great conversation starter, and even more conversations happen in cities. So many steps can be taken to minimize data concerns is the other point. There's a lot of data problems, but you can do a lot to prevent them. So the biggest issue is just to increase your sample size. Generally speaking, to minimize bias, you want at least 5,000 years of life at risk in your small area. So best way to solve your problems with unreliability of data is use larger samples. So you can use larger areas, so zip codes instead of tracts, census 2000 instead of census 2010. You can a lot of places, localities create new neighborhoods based on aggregations of census tracts, so they get bigger sizes. You can also use wider age groups. So we use 5-year age groups there. You can use 10-year age groups in some of the younger ages when there's less mortality. So the problems arise with that sparse data, and particularly with zero counts. If you have no deaths, no actual deaths, it means your life table is going to model nobody ever dying in that age range, which is kind of silly, right? So saying nobody's ever going to die between the ages of 10 and 14, even in your hypothetical population, is kind of silly. So substitutions are usually done. Sometimes the simple substitutions where you put half a death in just to have a small number that's non-zero. In our maps, we use a larger area, the surrounding county substitution rate. Our idea with that was that if we're going to bias the figure, we're going to bias it towards the much larger, more stable surrounding area rate. You could also use an average of the rates among neighbors. We did not use that in this case because we wanted to, we specifically were interested in highlighting those small area differences, so we didn't want to wash those out. A couple other things to watch out for are large population changes over time. So if the population change is too great, there's some cases where we just won't commit, we won't compute it. So if it's a small area with, you know, 30% population change over time, we just don't really trust our interpolated data between censuses. You can also peek at the population changes because you got to make sure zip codes didn't come and go. So if you've got death data aggregated by zip code from the health department and you assume that it's 10 years of deaths, but it's really only 7 years because the zip code went away, and you put that across 10 years of population, then you're going to be off. Group quarters is also worth paying attention to. Too many people in prisons and colleges really throw off your mortality rates and give you some very strange numbers, both on the high and low end. And this, real quickly as we wrap it up, this is an example of that substitution issue. And in our Northern Virginia project, we had a goal of computing life expectancy for 95% of the census tracts because they didn't want to have any gaps in their map. They wanted to pretty much have everything mapped. So just as an example of the substitution issue, these are the number of age groups out of 19 that were required to be substituted with that county, surrounding county rate. And just as an extreme example of the problem in rural areas in particular, so this is a populated area, and it still took us 14 years of death data and combining and reverting the data back to the 2000 Census Bureau to get rid of a bunch of tracts to get to the point where we only had five that had less than 10 age groups with zero counts that had to be substituted with the county data. So you have a lot of zero counts even with populist data. And then just in closing, I just wanted to point out that the stakeholder engagement piece is critical. So Abby mentioned it, and Sarah's going to follow up and talk about it. But just really quickly, the key to a successful map is not to make it just be a math exercise like a demography class assignment. We want the maps to have local relevance and advance the public health agenda in each area. And most importantly, we want to give them time to prepare for the release. So we have two sets of engagement that's critical. We have one set of engagement with the local folks to get details about accessing the data and the local epidemiology, identify any data issues and kind of go through the calculations. But then we also contact a set of officials in and out of health departments to understand the local policy landscape and know how the maps can be folded into an existing strategic plan. So Dr. Marita is going to talk all about how data can be used to do that sort of thing. So that's it. I'll stop there and ask any questions. I got my contact information. If I know it's kind of hard to race through stats things on a quick talk.
Got about 2 minutes for questions.
You got a couple minutes for questions? Yes. The question was just asking exactly what I meant about the group quarters. So the group quarters are in your population denominators, and presumably, if you're a college student and living there, and that's listed as your residence, and your mortality is then based on that. So if you have a large college dorm with a bunch of young people who are not dying, but you've got total population counts coming from the census, that can have abnormally high life expectancy. And similarly, if you had a large prison population with a higher mortality than normal, then that would throw things off.
But that population incarceration, so that actually means that the people who are incarcerated from that community are not included in that population. They're incarcerated elsewhere.
Oh, yes. So the incarceration issue also, So if they're from that community but elsewhere, then that's, they're not in that sample, So that, that's another problem you brought up. Thanks. Yes, sir. And that's a great point, that life expectancy is just the very beginning of the conversation. We haven't looked at, this is all-cause mortality, we haven't looked at disparities, and we haven't looked at quality of life, and so just living to a certain age is not the whole thing. The quality of life is critically important. That's a great point.
We'll have to hold questions.
Okay, we'll have to hold questions to the end, and we'll keep moving on. Thank you.